From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In 1991, as the Gulf War ended, Washington encouraged revolt in Iraq, then let it be crushed by Saddam Hussein. Now war drums are beating again in Washington. After another decade suffering under both Saddam Hussein's harsh rule and UN-imposed sanctions, the Iraqi people are being offered a future without Saddam. But will they accept America's offer? Will they welcome American soldiers in the streets of Baghdad during war and after it? This hour, On Point, we're pushing inside Iraq to try and read the hearts and minds of the Iraqi people. We begin tonight in Baghdad. The city of nearly 5 million was spared from invasion in 1991, but may now be a primary target for U.S. military action. Earlier, I spoke with Caroline Hawley, the BBC's correspondent in Baghdad. I asked her what impact the possibility of an impending American invasion is having on the Iraqi leadership and the Iraqi people.
Well, it's interesting, actually, being here in Baghdad. I mean, bizarrely, it's really business as usual in many respects. For example, last week, Baghdad hosted a tourism promotion conference. It went on to host the Babylon Arts Festival, which it has every year. But clearly people are worried. The leadership is very worried. It knows that the survival of the very regime is at stake. And certainly officials here are talking about the preparations they are making. They say that this is not a fight that they want. It's a fight that is being forced on them. But they will fight back. The Deputy Prime Minister, Tariq Aziz, was saying over the weekend that he called it the assault on Iraq, assuming that it would take place. The assault on Iraq would not be a picnic for the Americans, that it would lead to a fierce war. And I think Iraqi people are concerned as well. They are not hearing in their newspapers and on the state-run media much about the preparations, the war drums outside. What they're hearing, in fact, in the newspapers is about the opposition to the war in parts of the West. But certainly I think they are concerned. There's a lot of uncertainty here.
If and when an attack then comes, what's the thinking around Baghdad, that Saddam and his central core of leadership will dig in and fight all the way, or will they run and hide?
I think certainly the feeling is that it is in Saddam Hussein's nature to fight to the end. The question is how he would fight, and the key question, of course, who would fight with him.
What about the military? We've heard that there are distinctions in loyalty between the Republican Guard and the broader military. Is there any sign of disintegration, or what's the thinking among the diplomats there about how solid the overall military structure is?
This is something that's actually very, very difficult for people here in Baghdad to say. Certainly it's very difficult for me to say. We have our office, as most broadcasters do, in the Ministry of Information. We don't set foot outside the Ministry of Information without a government escort. So it's very, very difficult to find out these things. It's very difficult to find out what ordinary people really think, because they will not speak freely in front of a government escort.
That makes it very difficult for Westerners to have a sense of what seems like a key question, which is whether or not the Iraqi people, again, if and when an attack comes, would welcome American soldiers, or would, even in the civilian ranks, oppose them, fight against them. Do you have any sense at all? Can you? Does anyone who's reporting from Iraq?
It is the key question, the absolutely key question, and it is the question that is most difficult to answer here in Iraq. I mean, people will whisper that they want to see a change of the regime. The question is, do they want the Americans to bring about that change? And I think a really key thing for ordinary people here in Iraq is, what is the alternative? They have lived with this regime for 30 years. The Americans are now saying that they're going to topple it. They're not saying how they're going to do it, and they're not saying with who. Now, the Iraqi opposition in exile has been dismissed by a diplomat here to me as a bunch of puppets, crooks, and criminals. There is no sense of there being any Iraqi version of Hamid Karzai of Afghanistan. So I think for Iraqi people, there's deep uncertainty. They are worried that they will suffer from a war, and they don't know what the result of that war will be.
When you look at Saddam Hussein's political structure, his political party, how wide is the circle of what might be perceived as complicity? What percentage of Iraqis, at one way or another, can be seen as part of Saddam Hussein's political machine?
again, this is something that is very difficult for me to say. A lot of what happens in the Iraqi leadership is very secretive. We are only able to do here really what the authorities will allow us to do. That is something that's very, very difficult to assess. But certainly the Ba'ath Party, the ruling Ba'ath Party, does have people pretty much on every street, we understand. So I think they are keeping fairly tight control at the moment.
What is evident to the people of Iraq about Saddam Hussein at this point? Is he in public? Is he speaking with them? How high profile is he as the war drums go on?
Well, as ever, he is the front page of every newspaper here. He is featured prominently on Iraqi television whenever he, for example, chairs a cabinet meeting or a meeting of the top leadership. And he's on television a lot at the moment because on October the 15th, Iraqis will go to the vote. They'll go to the polls in a referendum voting on whether or not Saddam Hussein should have another 7 years in power. So Saddam Hussein is appearing on the television in heart shapes. Which is written, "Our beloved leader, yes to the beloved leader."
As the debate in the UN Security Council reaches a climax, do you have any sense at all of Baghdad of Iraq preparing for war?
Well, certainly the Iraqi officials, Iraqi authorities are saying that they are preparing for war, that they are preparing to fight back. We are not privy to any military information about what they're doing, although I have heard from diplomats, for example, that the hospitals are preparing. And certainly there is a fear on the streets here, whatever the end result of this war will be, that they will suffer along the way.
Are people stockpiling food, groceries, supplies, ordinary citizens in case of war?
I have to say there's no sense of major panic on the streets here. People are really going about their business as usual. That may well change as the threat grows bigger, but I think Iraqis are very, very fatalistic. They said, we've been through wars before, we've been through threats of war, and for the moment there are no signs really of ordinary people en masse taking extraordinary measures at the moment.
Caroline Holly, thank you for joining us.
Tom, you're welcome.
Caroline Holly is Iraq correspondent for the BBC. She spoke with us earlier from inside the Ministry of Information in Baghdad. We're talking tonight about the Iraqi people, their lives, their experiences, and their likely reaction to a looming war in Iraq. Will Iraqis from Mosul to Baghdad to Basra celebrate an American invasion? Will they resist? Tonight we're stretching to read beneath Saddam Hussein's iron fist. What do the Iraqi people really want? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Zainab Al-Suwaij. She fled Iraq after the 1991 uprising and is now executive director of the American Islamic Congress. Good evening and welcome, Zainab Al-Suwaij.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for being with us.
Appreciate that.
Zainab Al-Suwaij, you have written, as someone who was in Iraq during the Gulf War and in its aftermath and saw the uprising there and saw that uprising crushed, you have written that the Iraqi people were scarred by that experience of Washington essentially letting them down after encouraging them to revolt.
Definitely.
But in your words, if Washington comes in again and cracks the whole issue of Saddam Hussein's power open again, you've written, the good news is that I guarantee the Iraqis will make sure the job gets finished this time. Are you suggesting by that Iraqis, and I know that's a big term and we'll have to break it down, but that Iraqis will actually welcome American soldiers in the streets of Baghdad, in the streets of your hometown, Basra, that a military attack will be welcomed, embraced, and supported by the Iraqi people? Is that your view?
Well, the Iraqi people have been through a lot, and they are welcoming any support and any help for their freedom and liberty from Saddam Hussein dictatorship.
What is your evidence of that? When did you leave Iraq?
In 1991.
So you haven't been there in a decade.
That's right.
What's the evidence that you're pointing to? Because this question is so important. America's had the experience in the past of military action that did not have the support of local people. What are you basing your assessment on that the Iraqi people are supportive and ready for U.S. military action?
Well, the Iraqi people, the best example for that is in 1991 when President Bush encouraged Iraqis, if they want to change their government, that will help them. So the Iraqi people rose up against Saddam Hussein, and they liberated 15 states out of 18, and they were waiting for the help that they promised by the American government. But unfortunately, that help never came. And so this is the best example for that. And people are still now eager, now actually much more than 10 years ago or 11 years ago, to be free and live a regular human life.
We saw what happened 10 years ago. We saw the Kurds rise up against Saddam Hussein in the north. We saw Shiite Muslims rise up against Saddam Hussein in the south. We also saw Saddam Hussein just mercilessly put both of those down.
That's right.
But 10 years later, again, how can you know that today the situation is the same? I'm reading here in a Washington Post, long Washington Post, Washington Post report from a week ago from Karbala, another area south of Baghdad, a strong Shiite area, that is, as opposed to the dominant Sunni Muslim group in Iraq. And they're talking about Saddam Hussein, how he has gone out of his way in the years since 1991 to curry respect, friendship, loyalty, even in this town, to the point that the statue of Saddam in this town now shows him bowing in prayer. He's adopted a more and more Islamic posture toward the population. They're quoting people here in Karbala saying, you know, people used to hang pictures in their shops because they were afraid what would happen to them if they didn't. But today, Saddam has actually cultivated, even if grudging, a kind of respect and support. Do you think this Washington Post reporter simply has it wrong?
Well, definitely people there, they cannot say what they like or what they think or what they think it's happening, actually. They have to pretend and they have to say, you know, they are happy and they are doing this from their own will. Just like in the past when I was in Iraq, they used to ask us to go and rally in the street and say we love Saddam and we want Saddam. If we refused to leave school and go out in the street saying this, then we will be punished. And the minimum punishment will be to be jailed or killed. Not only the person that who refused, but the whole family will be destroyed.
Do you think it's all still about physical intimidation, the threat of violence against Iraqis? Is it not possible that in these years of portraying himself as the champion of Islam, the champion of the Iraqi people, that he's won some support? Is it all just going to crumble that quickly? I read here also in the Washington Post report, the reporter saying he traveled without government minders watching it every moment. He said Western-oriented college students, black-turban Shiite clerics, and soldiers who were forced to retreat from Kuwait said in often lengthy interviews that their allegiances to Hussein are firm, challenging assumptions by some of his opponents that Iraqis would quickly turn against him in the event of a military confrontation with the United States. This is from September 22nd. This is one week ago, essentially.
That's right.
What's wrong with this picture?
Well, as I said, people are there are not free. And most of them, even if they see them, some of them with turbans or whatever their background is, most of them, they work for the Secret Service or for the intelligence with Saddam. And they cannot, if they are regular people in the street, they cannot definitely speak their mind.
Do you have, Zeynep al-Sawej, any way of communicating directly with Iraqis in Iraq at this point?
Yes, I do.
By email? By
no emails, but sometimes telephone calls. But, of course, people, they cannot say what's going on over the phone because phones are, you know, tapped and people can, you know... government
so
can hear it, and
they cannot speak frankly.
But I have friends who they come out of Iraq and they call and they.
But you're so deeply confident, in spite of the inability to speak freely with Iraqis today, mm-hmm. that they will support Americans. What about, let's say that there's an attack, and let's say it's successful. Let's say Saddam is ousted. What about American soldiers patrolling the streets of Baghdad, of Basra, of patrolling Iraqi oil fields. Can you imagine this? There's talk of a long-term occupation. Could Iraqis tolerate such a thing?
Well, what we are talking about here is stabilizing the country after Saddam's leaves, and then it will be hopefully a democratic government that, you know, they held an election and will be a federal democratic country just like any other countries.
And would such a republic, a democratic Iraq, continue to welcome an American occupation force like Germany did, like Japan did?
Why we say it's an occupation, we say it's a help that coming from America to help the Iraqi people, to liberate the Iraqi people.
We're looking inside Iraq tonight. We're trying to assess the outlook of the Iraqi people as the war, as the world wages war. You can join us. Saddam doesn't want the U.S. military invading, but do you think the Iraqi people do? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tonight, we're looking inside Iraq, trying to assess the outlook, the attitudes of the Iraqi people as the world wages war on Iraq. In war, would U.S. troops be fighting alongside or against the people of Iraq? And will we see flowers and dancing in the streets of Baghdad, or civilians dug in and shooting back, or neutral? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I've been talking in studio with Zeynep Al-Sawej. She's Iraqi. She left Iraq after the failed uprisings of 1991 that were encouraged by Washington and then abandoned in the wake of the Gulf War. She's currently executive director of the American Islamic Congress. I'm joined now by Robert Lieber. He's a professor of government and foreign service at Georgetown University. He's an expert on U.S. Middle East policy. Good evening and welcome, Robert Lieber.
Good evening.
Robert Lieber, you have written that the U.S. government has a big job ahead of it in advance of war in setting the ground psychologically for the Iraqi people to support a U.S.-led invasion if and when it comes. How do you think the United States is doing on that front so far?
Well, it remains to be seen, but I very much agree with your in-studio guest that the Iraqi people have suffered incredibly under one of the most tyrannical regimes that the modern world has seen, and that they will see themselves as liberated when Saddam Hussein is ousted. I think that's the biggest dimension of this, and the other questions are subsidiary. Now, having said that, in response to your specific question, we don't know. With all due respect to whoever that Washington Post reporter is, the notion that you can go in, travel freely, and have the Iraqi people tell you exactly what they think is an incredible example of naivete and ethnocentrism. This is a society in which even to make a joke about Saddam or to otherwise have your loyalty called into question can result in the most barbaric tortures and punishments for yourself as well as your entire family, including your children, your wife, the women of your family, and so forth.
And we've heard many reports of that. Yeah.
I was going to say, I'd go into more detail, but this show is being aired at a time when children may be listening, and it would be enough to give them nightmares for a month.
And no one denies that there's been very wide-scale, cruel, harsh, and deep oppression. At the same time, the Post reporter's noting that Saddam Hussein has promoted the growth of Islamic fundamentalism to stoke anti-American sentiment, that he's managed to deflect criticism of domestic problems by blaming the UN economic sanctions, that he's sought to instill a sense of pride among Iraqis in defiance of the United States, that he's doled out modest new freedoms, including internet access, the ability to watch foreign music videos. You think this is all eyewash, Robert Lieber?
Well, you asked me a straight question. I'll give you a straight answer. Yes, I do.
Mm-hmm.
And the point from the piece I had written recently that you quoted is that I and a co-author had argued that it was desirable and important for the U.S. to do its utmost to signal to the broader Iraqi population that we want to oust Saddam, liberate them, and help them attain a much better future economically, politically, and socially, and that we're not there to oppress or conquer them, but to oust this appalling ruler and deal with his weapons of mass destruction, which are a threat to the region and the entire world.
How do you think the United States is doing on that part of the equation so far? You've said, you've noted that the population has been, using your word, brainwashed for years about U.S. imperialist Middle East policies. You've said that their own experience has given them little reason to think otherwise. The Gulf War was a disaster for the Iraqi people, and that Washington needs to send an unequivocal message of hope to the Iraqi people. Is that being done? You said it needs to be done months in advance of a military campaign.
Well, I think,
how are we doing?
Well, we have only fragmentary information. Frankly, you can't conduct a Gallup poll there, but there have been a series of different efforts through different means, including broadcasting, and I think the real test will come once the fighting begins and Saddam is overthrown. But I think there are very strong reasons historically, as well as personally, as enunciated in a very compelling way by your previous guest, Zeynep Al-Sawej, that the Iraqi public will not resist the American and allied efforts to oust Saddam. I think you're going to find that there will be you will get risings as you did before. And let me correct one statement you made a few minutes ago. You referred to the Shiites and then a reference to the majority Sunnis. The Sunnis are a majority in the Arab world, but inside Iraq, the Shiites, who are primarily in the south as well as in parts of Baghdad, are 60% of the population.
Yes, I understand, and I did not say majority. I said dominant, and I understand
dominant,
the distinction.
Yes,
but you're quite right. The Sunnis dominant through the gun barrel, and we've often heard about the internal tensions in Iraq and fear that the country itself could fly apart. We're talking tonight with Robert Lieber of Georgetown University and Zainab Al-Suwaij, Executive Director of the American Islamic Congress. We're trying to look inside Iraq and assess the outlook of Iraq's own people as the world wages war. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Bulwer's calling from Boston. Hi, Bulwer. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. Yeah, as I said to you earlier, my wife is from Iraq. She fled Iraq after the first Gulf War. She's presently back in the north of Iraq. And I just wanted to say that the American people have no idea or very little idea of how horrendous and how cruel the rule under the present leadership of Iraq is. And I dare say that I have never met any Iraqi who is not a member of what they call the Iraqi Secret Service who would not welcome, and that's an understatement, the liberation of any foreign force in Iraq. I've seen people in this country protesting over the effects of the sanctions on the Iraqi children.
Mm-hmm.
But all Iraqis know fully well that Saddam has been responsible for more damage, more debt, more brutality, and has taught his people nothing but war, an exceedingly rich country. So I would say that they need to speak to people who know about Iraq. Nobody can visit Iraq or report from Iraq and tell you about the true Iraq.
And, Bill, what do you think about the prospect of American soldiers, let's say, patrolling Baghdad street corners 6 or 8 months from now? Can you imagine the Iraqi people accepting that or welcoming that?
Well, you must remember there's a thing called Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Iraq is a very proud country. You know, they know fully well what that word means. It's the root of civilization. You see, Saddam is a megalomaniac. He sees himself as the second Nebuchadnezzar who would rule that area. Mm-hmm. And people's prime interest right now is to get out of that misery that has been inflicted upon them by a selfish and a brutal leadership. So the question of American troops patrolling the streets of Iraq, the sensitivity, you know, these Arab countries are wrong, talk about what it would have, the destabilizing effect. That mm-hmm. is nothing but a selfish statement,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
The people of Iraq want freedom. They're in jail. They want liberation. And it doesn't matter if it comes from a dog, right? They are willing to be liberated, and every Iraqi knows that.
Bulwer, thank you for your call. Zainab Al-Suwaij, there's an affirmation of your view. I guess that leaves me wondering, if there is that kind of potential support waiting there, how can the United States maximize that sentiment of opposition to Saddam, that sentiment of potential support? Are there better or worse ways of going about encouraging change in Iraq that are most likely to elicit support?
Well, they have to. I think the support is already there. And if the American government decide to take an action tomorrow, then you will find 22 million Iraqis backing them up without a need for calling them. I mean, people are there under all of this kind of stress. They are waiting for the moment to be liberated.
And Robert Lieber, we're talking very generally about the people of Iraq here. You've thought specifically about the circle of people most intimately around Saddam Hussein. What about at that very inner level of Saddam Hussein's core supporters? Can they be peeled away from him, and what's the best way to do it?
Well, first of all, I want to say your previous caller was extremely eloquent, and I just wish more of the sort of naive opponents of change in Iraq would listen to a caller like that who expresses the anguish and grief of the suffering inflicted on the Iraqis by Saddam Hussein and his thuggish regime. The point you're referring to is that you have basically something which is loosely equivalent to the Nazi Party, that is the upper reaches of the Ba'ath Party, mm-hmm. Who are a thuggish and corrupt outfit that dominate the country and have really impoverished the middle class. The people closest to Saddam, the people calling the shots, have to be removed in a process of what might be called, for want of another word, and I apologize for the analogy because it's crude, but denazification, just as took place in Germany after World War II.
What's the best way to do that?
Let me just finish. The rank and file, the people who operate the public services, who keep the water system and electricity system going, mm-hmm. those people may or may not be party members, but are almost certainly don't necessarily have to be gotten rid of. It's the people really at the top, closest to Saddam, who have to be dealt with for his regime to be out.
And the most effective way to peel away those concentric circles, you've said, is to enunciate in advance of an attack a very concrete plan for Iraq that would give unequivocal hope. What would be the elements of such a plan?
Well, a couple of things. One, to signal to the Iraqis that we want them to be prosperous, to have a successful political federation, that we're not threatening the territorial integrity of Iraq, that they should be continue to be a self-governing, proud, independent country with a very advanced population, that we want to help them modernize their economy, develop, and have a pluralistic, open political system. I think all that is doable, and I might note that in the recent newspaper accounts indicate that the Bush administration seems to be trying to signal directly to Iraqi military officers in ways which would discourage them from using weapons of mass destruction, particularly the biological mm-hmm. and chemical weapons that Saddam still has and which the UNSCOM inspection teams indicated still existed at the time they were forced out in 1998. The idea is to try to get the rank and file officers not to use those things, both because of opposition to Saddam and for fear of their own necks if they do use them.
And what about getting the message into the Iraqi people? Of course, we can't judge from the inside, but you have said that it would take an effort from the outside lasting several months so that essentially all Iraqis or the majority of Iraqis knew, here's what the United States plans, here's what they're promising, this is why we should get on board. Is that happening to the best of your knowledge, Robert Lieber?
I think at this distance we can't know. I think efforts are being made. It's certainly evident from some of the press reports. There are different types of radio broadcasting going on and other efforts to try to inform both the Iraqi public and Iraqi military officers. At this distance, it's hard to know in advance how effective that's going to be. But ultimately, I think the points that your previous caller made and that Zainab al-Suwaish made about the suffering of the Iraqis, that the vast majority of the people want to be freed of this tyrannical regime, it's those things that are going to matter. And let me add one final point. I think America's foremost scholar and expert on the modern Arab world is Fuad Ajami. Ajami said a decade ago that had the U.S. Army or Marines got to Baghdad, they would have been viewed as liberators. I think that is still likely to be the case today, and I think Ajami has more or less said the same thing. There's a separate question about how long U.S. forces should remain, and I think there are probably good cultural and other reasons why, once Saddam is ousted, it would be preferable if the immediate presence of U.S. forces is limited as much as possible, and others are involved in working with the Iraqis to put in place a moderate, pluralistic mm-hmm. government that meets the needs and will of the Iraqi population.
We will talk about that. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Joan's calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Joan. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to respond. Well, I guess it's really to both your experts.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I just want to say that, yeah, I do agree that, you know, Hussein is a really cruel dictator. But also, I want to ask if, you know, how the Iraqi people would welcome Americans. Well, if there right now we are protecting, and I'm putting that word in quotation marks, the no-fly zone, and it is over Basra, and we are dropping bombs on Basra all the time. Civilians are being killed. This isn't in our main media, but if you listen to independent media, you will hear this is happening. So if I was a mother, and I am a mother,
you'd be concerned about that. Joan, let me put that to Zainab here in the studio, and thank you for your call. Zainab, what about it? The U.S. military will no doubt make every effort to spare civilian life to the extent possible, but we are told that Saddam Hussein may be planning to dig in civilian centers. And we saw in Afghanistan, we saw in the Gulf War that civilian casualties and significant casualties do occur. How are the people of Iraq likely to deal with that factor, that in a U.S. military invasion, even if it brings a regime change, even if that's desired, it will not be bloodless?
That's true. But we have to think about that Saddam is killing Iraqi people every single day. Hundreds of people being killed. There are 2 to 3 days when Saddam when Saddam clean up the jails by executing the prisoners and bringing more people. Mistakes, dropping bombs here and there, it happened, and this is a fact of a war in the area. But this is not more than the people that they have been killed right now every single day. I know it's hard to deal with, but people are very anxious for their freedom.
And you think they'll accept those losses? You saw losses in considerable volume in 1991 in the last uprising.
And after we rose up against the government, Saddam starts throwing bombs at us and asking the people to leave the cities. So people start rushing outside the city in hundreds and thousands of people, and then threw bombs in the middle and kill most of these civilian and kids and pregnant ladies and so on and so forth, and leave the bodies in the street, not allowing the families or the relatives of these people to bury the bodies.
And if we see that kind of response again, of course, you saw it in the South where there was Shiite resistance to Baghdad. How do we meld that together with the Sunni population in the center of the country?
Well, even the Sunni population, I mean, if you look at in 1991, for example, Basra was not only, it's not only for Shia. There are Sunnis sharing the city, and there are some Christians and other minorities. All of them, they rush together. So it doesn't matter whether Sunni or Shia or Christian in Iraq. All of them, I think Saddam is treating most of them equally in terms of torturing all of them at the same level.
We're talking tonight about Iraq. We're looking inside Iraq and trying to assess the outlook of the Iraqi people as the world weighs war. Iraqis rose up against Saddam Hussein with U.S. encouragement in 1991. Will they do it again in 2002, in 2003? Is war the only way to get the Iraqi people what they want and what they need? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking inside Iraq tonight, trying to assess the outlook of the Iraqi people as the world weighs war there. Iraqis rose up against Saddam Hussein with U.S. encouragement in 1991. Will they do it again this year? Will they do it again in 2003? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests tonight are Zainab Al-Sawej, Executive Director of the American Islamic Congress. She's Iraqi who fled Iraq in 1991 after seeing an uprising and its bloody suppression in southern Iraq, Basra, her hometown. We're joined from Washington, D.C. tonight by Robert Lieber. He's Professor of Government and Foreign Service at Georgetown University. You're welcome to join us as well at 1-800-423-TALK. Bob is calling from Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Good evening. My question is pretty much, as you know, the Shah of Iran got ousted by his people, even though he ruled with an iron fist, as was Marcos and numerous other U.S.-sponsored tyrants, if I may use that word, and I just don't quite see this great opposition. Sure, you're going to have discredited people, and nobody's overly too happy with their government, and I'm sure there's business people down there. They wish they could trade with the West and wish they could get Saddam out. But nationalization is the problem, the nationalization of resources in Iran.
So you're saying, Bob, that in Iraq, you're not believing that opposition is as strong as you're hearing tonight.
Well, I don't see why they're not out there demonstrating. I mean, if Saddam's shooting people protesting with signs out in the streets, I'm sure we're going to hear about it. Iraq is not that isolated.
Well, it's pretty isolated. We've got your point. I noted earlier, talking with Caroline Hawley of the BBC, that we actually had to stop our interview a couple of times because she said to me in response to some of my questions, this was cut off the tape, that she simply couldn't answer because she was being monitored so closely by officials in the Ministry of Information, she was uncomfortable in answering the very direct questions that I was asking. But Robert Lieber, perhaps you could speak to this. Bob is looking at the news and he's not seeing opposition on the streets of Baghdad to Saddam Hussein. Maybe we do need to get a little more explicit about the methods and techniques of this government in suppressing opposition.
Yeah, the premises of the question are simply wrong and don't apply to Iraq. This is a regime whose leader has been responsible for the murder of at least 200,000 of his own people. This is a leader from whom something like 4 million Iraqi citizens have fled, become refugees in response to his tyranny. This is a regime where the Kurds in the north, who represent 20 to 25% of the population, the Shiites in the south, 60% of the population, rose up to try to overthrow Saddam, captured or took over 15 of Iraq's 18 provinces, and then were crushed by Saddam's tanks and helicopter gunships and the forces of the Republican Guard because the U.S. wouldn't intervene and allowed the Iraqi helicopter gunships to fly. This is a society in which a man making a joke about Saddam suffers. Well, let me not go into it. It would make your listeners not want to sleep tonight and lose their dinner.
Well,
the fact is that the slightest appearance of anything but enthusiastic support for Saddam can result in the most hideous things happening to you as an individual, but equally or even worse to the members of your extended family. And consequently, the kinds of expressions of open dissent that your caller refers to are simply not practical in a society in which a tyrannical regime is in power and doesn't hesitate to use the most draconian measures against anyone.
I hear what you're saying, and yet I'm still
reading.
Yeah, but
are you processing?
I'm fully processing it, Mr. Lieber, quite fully processing it. I'm reading here in a report from Zainab Al-Sawaj of people being put into human meat grinders. But I'm also processing what I'm reading in the Washington Post. I'm trying to put these together, and Zainab, perhaps you can help us.
Sure.
He's quoting a low-level, he says, government functionary in Baghdad saying, a decade ago, I would have welcomed the Americans. But not now. He's quoting someone else who says, this is 1 week ago in Iraq, if America says it cares for us so much, why did they impose these sanctions on us? Do you think that a decade of grinding poverty, of great difficulty at the expense of sanctions, might have in some way blunted enthusiasm for American intervention in this country, despite the tyrannical governing style of Saddam Hussein's party?
Mm-hmm. Well, as I said, people feel that they cannot speak freely. I say it one more time.
Mm-hmm.
And, they know that the cause of their suffering right now is Saddam Hussein, is not America. Why didn't America sanction Iraq 12 years ago? Why didn't America do that, things before?
Mm-hmm.
They, all of them knew, and they are aware of Saddam is the one who's caused that. But at the same time, they cannot talk about this. And the government try to impress on them that they will not talk about that. And they try to make them believe that America is the bad enemy, that the cause of our suffering back there in Iraq. And
do you think that in 10 years of being more or less cut off from the world, the government's had any success in promoting that message?
Well, they are trying their best to give that message or make it clear to the Iraqis. But the Iraqis, deep inside, they don't believe in it. And every time I ask any Iraqi who just came recently out of Iraq, every time I ask them how the thing is in Iraq, they said, well, things are terrible. And that's what, did you see what Saddam caused, what did he do to our
mm-hmm,
life?
Mm-hmm. Alex is calling from Watertown, Massachusetts. Hi, Alex. You're on the air.
Hello.
Good evening.
Thank you. It's just, it's really frustrating to hear all this stuff about Saddam being said. Let me just say initially that I'm by no means a fan of this man. He's a megalomaniac and a tyrant, and it's a draconian regime, as your speaker had said. That's... You know, in terms of this debate about whether the U.S. should pretty much unilaterally invade, I think that's a given. What we are missing in the debate is a look at the historical record, which clearly shows the hypocrisy of this U.S. administration, where they had ignored the previous assaults by Saddam against his own people, when chemical weapons were used against the Iranians at the end of the Iran-Iraq War,
mm-hmm.
and so on. There was no outcry in the United States. There was no massive press coverage. There was no calls for invasion and UN resolutions and so on. And all of a sudden, to be talking about liberation just seems a little bit hypocritical. Also, to address this question of whether the Iraqi people would support an invasion, I think, as a previous caller had said, there would be support in order to just get rid of this man. There's a hierarchy of needs, and if you're under a fascist government, you'll pretty much take whoever's help in getting rid of it. But I would not be so quick to say that they would support a U.S. Installed regime in the aftermath. Look at all the up to a million people, as the UN has said, that have died as a result of U.S. imposed sanctions, and all kinds of they hadn't. Supported the uprising in the past. They allowed these people to be slaughtered.
Alex, we've got it, and we see it. There's checkered history here, but we're really looking tonight at what people think now. Robert Lieber, what about it? As you say, Iraqi people, they're nobody's fool. They've watched what's gone on over the last 10, 20 years. They've seen in 1991, and Zainab saw firsthand, the United States not come through after it had encouraged revolt. Do you think there's a kind of built-in skepticism here?
Well, there's a built-in caution. The Kurds in the north, for instance, have been betrayed three times with devastating results in 1975, in 1991 when they rose up, and again in the mid-1990s. And they're not going to put their necks on the line unless they're certain the U.S. and its allies are going to see it through. But let me say that the brutal realities of power are extremely important. Once it becomes clear that the U.S. is going to see this through and it's able to make its intentions work to oust Saddam, I think you're going to see exactly the kind of rallying to the United States and to the allies and against Saddam that your other guest has referred to. The population is sick to death of this tyrannical regime, and once it becomes clear that the U.S. is determined to follow this through the way we unfortunately failed to do in the last days of the war in 1991.
Mm. Robert Lieber, with that, we're just about out of time, but I want to thank you for joining us tonight. It's been great having you. Robert Lieber is professor of government and foreign service at Georgetown University. And Zainab Al-Sawaj, thanks so much for being here in the studio with us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Zainab Al-Sawaj is a native of Iraq, of Basra in southern Iraq. She's currently executive director of the American Islamic Congress. You can continue this conversation online. Log on to onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The best news that Florida Democrats have heard in a long time. Challenger Bill McBride has pulled to within 6 points of Republican Governor Jeb Bush in polls released today. On Friday, the two candidates squared off in their first televised debate. Much of the debate focused on education and Florida's embattled Department of Children and Families. Here are excerpts from the debate, beginning with Jeb Bush responding to a question about the DCF.
We have 45,000 kids in the custody of the state. Think about that for a moment. They're not there by circumstance. They're there because parents have abandoned or neglected or abused their kids. 4 years ago, I outlined a detailed plan that said we needed to fund our child welfare system more, and we've doubled the budget in the last 4 years in our child welfare system. We still have a long way to go, and so our budget recommendation for the next year is to increase pay for counselors, is to use technology correctly, to get our law enforcement agencies much more involved at the beginning so that we can assure that kids in our care aren't lost.
Mr. McBride, let me ask you, what would you do as governor at the Department of Children and Families that Governor Bush has not done?
Well, Michael, this is an incredible transformation. 4 years ago, Governor Bush made two big promises to the people of Florida. One, that he was going to clean up the mess of the Department of Children and Families, and the other was he was going to improve our public schools. It reminds me a little bit of a man I met when my freshman year in college. I went back to Leesburg, and I got a job picking oranges with a crew from Barbados. And there was this one guy, and he wasn't a very good worker. He'd get up, put his ladder in the tree, and he let a lot of fruit go on the ground, except when the boss came around. And when the boss came around, he'd jump down out of the tree and pick up all this fruit. I sort of sense that with these new changes with the governor. The big boss is coming on November 5th. And now he's down scrambling, going to improve Department of Children and Families and improve our public education. It's a transformation of enormous magnitude. I just think the people of Florida won't buy this.
All right, let's go on to the next question. And it is sort of the basic question that I think people have tuned in to find out. It is from Deb Newman of Fort Myers.
It appears as though on the commercials or things that I've heard, you're all focusing basically on the same issues. My question would be, what do you think separates you from the other candidate?
Governor?
Well, I assume it's on education would be the main issue that we talk about, and there's a huge difference. I believe in high standards and high expectations and accurate assessments and accountability where we reward improvement and we provide help in the chronically underperforming schools, but we don't tolerate mediocrity. And because of that system and because we've funded public education now to the tune of a $3 billion increase, we're seeing rising student achievement for the first time in a long while. Our graduation rate is rising. Our dropout rate is dropping. My opponent wants to go back to the old way where we excuse away the fact that too many kids weren't learning. And he wants to the system will control him. He's had great support from the union bosses, but that's not what is going to improve quality education in this state.
Mr. McBride, let me ask you that question, or the question that Deb Newman asked, and that is, what sets you apart from Mr. Bush?
The governor says things are just fine. I have kids in public schools. I know what's going on there. He says our crime rates are down. We rank 49th or 50th in the United States in crime rates. He says the public schools are doing just fine, and he's helping these children. It's just simply not true. This $3 billion barely has kept track with inflation and student enrollment growth, and we've lost ground compared to every other state in the country. Now, this governor should level with the people of Florida. We're not doing better. Now, I want accountability, and I think accountability is fair, but let me tell you what parents want. Parents want to know how big their classes are going to be for their kids. They want to know how many teachers are teaching within their areas of expertise. They want to know how big the school is because they won't want their kids lost. This governor's bragging about something that hasn't occurred. Our public schools are in crisis. Student achievement isn't up in Florida. What we're doing is we're stressing kids like they never have been before. You should not use this system, this one FCAT system, you can't give high-stakes tests with kids. What you need is a system of true accountability that's going to give parents the information that they need.
Those were excerpts from the first debate between Florida Governor Jeb Bush and Democratic challenger Bill McBride. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.